just a little disclaimer up front. The findings of the report that you've, if you've had a chance to read it, are those of the authors, and that's myself, Bruce Turris from Pacific Fisheries Management, and Howard McAdary of Archipelago Marine Research. GMRI has commissioned this report, and for the purposes of providing information to sector organizers and to the Council and the National Marine Fisheries Service. They don't endorse necessarily anything in the report, nor do they have any specific views on standards for monitoring, perhaps. But they feel that the information and the communication of this report would stimulate discussion on the matter. A copy of the report can be found on their website. We do know that there are proposals by a number of groups of multi-species permit holders who want to opt out of the current input control system and look at sector management. There's a recognition that the fishing industry and other groups, environmental groups, fisheries managers, that the current monitoring system probably won't be adequate for sector management if it's implemented. There is a lack of consensus or agreement on what those rules should be for monitoring within sector management, which is the purpose in part for this report. So to facilitate that development and discussion, the GMRI commissioned the authors to assess the monitoring and existing monitoring and reporting needs, as well as the needs for sector management in the New England fisheries. Howard and I have extensive experience in designing and implementing monitoring programs, mostly on the west coast of Canada, but also in other jurisdictions, including the United States and Australia. And we're trying to bring some of that experience to this report. The phase one report is what I'm presenting here today. There is a phase two to this report. It'll be presented, hopefully, if the Council so agrees, at the June Council meeting in Portland, Maine. The Phase 1 report focuses on what's needed for sector management monitoring and accountability levels for at-sea catch and releases of regulated groundfish species. The Phase 2 report will focus more on the implementation advice for monitoring programs and the associated costs, including the evaluation of different options. I'm going to skip through the background information in the report. I know all of you are very much aware of it all, so we won't take your time up with it. It's in the report, though, if you'd like to refer to it. We are going to identify, though, the concerns with the current management program and what brings about the need for improved monitoring under sector management, perhaps even without sector management. Some of the things that in our meetings with industry and government representatives and non-government representatives that we took note of were increasing levels of discarding, their misreporting of discards or the unreported discards, misreporting of species catch on an area and species-specific basis, both released and retained catch, the delay and the lack of timeliness in collecting information for responsible, timely decision-making for management purposes, both sector management and TAC management, could take currently up to 2 months and just to get the data into the system and perhaps even up to 6 months to know what total catch and total mortality was for a stock. Industry has indicated that the input controls are becoming increasingly restrictive and difficult to operate under, and a further consequence of that is that the economic viability for some of the operations within the fleet are questionable. Clearly, this has led to some discussion about sector management. And what we know about sector management is that, based on the new legislation, that TACs will be established as shares of the annual catch limits. There will also be accountability measures that are consistent with the fisheries management plan reporting requirements. Sector shares will be allocated as a percentage of those ACLs applicable for that fisheries management plan, Discards will not count against the sector's allocation, but they will count against their shares unless they have some type of accountability or monitoring program which will allow for exemptions to the assumed discard rates. Any sector reaching sector allocation would be closed down, or their fishery would be closed. It would be required, all sectors would be required to report their catches in a consistent, regular manner as outlined in the Fisheries Management Plan reporting requirements. And transfers of annual catch entitlements may be allowed between sectors on an annual basis. It's not clear how many sectors may be involved, but our discussions indicate somewhere between 12 and 19. Membership will be somewhat influenced by the gear type, the focus on different species, organizational relationships, and as well as the regionalization of the organizations and the individuals. Many will be managed internally with individual allocations that allow vessels to move their annual catch entitlements around to improve the efficiency of their operations and to essentially get the fish out of the water for that sector. Many in industry, at least from our accounts and discussions, see sector management as a means for moving away from what they see as inefficient input control management, the use of days at sea, regulatory closures, and rolling closures and trip limits. They also see it as a way of reducing or removing the need for regulatory discards and improving the ability to maximize the harvest of available yields. Even with sector management, however, there's still going to be conservation concerns. By itself, sector management won't stop high grading and won't resolve misreporting problems that you have currently. So the need to be accountable and stay within those sector allocations, those annual catch limits, requires that you have a proper monitoring program that accurately and timely accounts for the total catch and removals on a sector, not only a sector basis, but also on a species and area basis, and that information is available for sector managers and fisheries managers on a timely basis. Of course, everybody has their objectives for a sector management and monitoring program. While some of these overlap, there are distinct differences between the resource manager's needs and those of the industry. The resource manager is looking for improved quantification of total mortality on a stock basis, so that's on a species and area basis, both at sea retained catch and mortality, as well as discards. He would like the information on a more timely basis. Hopefully a monitoring program would improve compliance within the fishery, and the data collected based on the types of monitoring programs you have, either at sea or dockside, would also assist in improved stock assessment. Industry has similar objectives in terms of timely and accurate collection of information and data. Sector managers, if they're responsible for reporting on a timely basis their utilization of their sector allocations, would want that timely information. They also see monitoring as providing a level playing field to ensure that all participants have similar standards and reporting requirements. Of course, industry would want the program to be affordable. And insofar as that they allow for the benefits of sector management through improved economic efficiencies, reduced operating costs and consolidation of operations, better servicing of market needs, and so on, monitoring programs would aid in providing improved economic benefits to the industry. As you've seen in the discussion paper, there's three different monitoring options that are presented, one a progression of the other, and options within the second and third. And there's a number of tools that are brought forward in those options. Some of them are quite familiar to you, but there are some additional ones. I just want to briefly touch on them. You have the VMS, of course, the vessel monitoring system that you've been using for a number of years. Vessel trip reports, which essentially is the vessel's record of the catch while at sea fishing. May have to be expanded a little bit to include things on a set-by-set basis. Dealer reports, which are provided by the buyer of the fish, giving the accurate landed weights on a species basis. A hail program, which allows the vessel to hail out and hail in its intended fishing operations, where they're going, when they're landing, where the fish will be landed in some cases, the amount of fish or estimates of the amount of fish that they're landed. A dockside monitoring program, which is often referred to as a Waymaster program, which provides an independent verification of the weights being on a species and a weight basis being offloaded at the processing plant or the auction for sale. It often involves things like roving monitors who, for vessels that are offloading to trucks at remote ports, just to confirm how much product was coming off or an estimate of the product coming off. Of course, the dockside monitor, which does the independent verification of the weights and species. And then the product of that being the landings report. Electronic monitoring program, which is an at-sea monitoring using cameras, GPS and sensors, often hydraulic sensors or motion sensors, which record the vessel's activity in terms of where it's fishing, what it's catching and releasing, and presents an electronic monitoring report at the completion of the trip. And similar to the electronic monitoring, you have the at-sea observer program, one that you already have here in the region, where an onboard observer records the activities of the vessel in terms of catch and releases, and as well as can collect biological samples and biological information for assessment purposes. The product from the observer is the observer report. So we use in our discussion document, we use all of these tools to present three different monitoring options. Option one is essentially a modified status quo of what you have now. The only difference is that we've added a hail program carried out by an independent contractor. But it continues to use the vessel monitoring system, the vessel trip report, and the dealer reports. Option two builds on option one by adding dockside monitoring. And as you can see, you can go from less than 100% dockside monitoring, where you would also use dealer reports in the absence of dockside monitoring, to the a complete 100% dockside monitoring program. And the final option is option three, which builds on options one and two by adding at-sea monitoring. And similar to option two, there's various levels of at-sea monitoring, less than 100%, all the way up to 100%, either electronic or at-sea observer coverage. So I'm just going to quickly walk through the three options, identify how they work and the differences between them. So the modified status quo, essentially, again, it's similar to the current program, adds a hail program done through an independent contractor. Vessel intends on going out to fish. It hails out to the contractor, provides information about when it's leaving, where it plans on going to fish, and its intended landing date. It receives a hail out number, and that's recorded in its vessel trip report. Of course, the VMS is still on board, and that information will still be collected by NIMS for enforcement purposes. And we also assume that the NIMS at Sea Observer program will still be operating at the levels that they have, 5% for the A base program and up to 30% for the B and the SAP and the Canada-US programs. And upon completion of their fishing operations, the vessel will hail in. It'll advise the contractor of where it plans to land the fish, a rough estimate of the amount of fish on board, and then we'll receive a hail and number that it will again record in the vessel trip report. The vessel trip report will be submitted within 7 days of offloading to the contractor by the vessel operator, and the purchaser of the fish will submit a completed dealer report also within 7 days of receiving the fish. So the contractor then uses the vessel trip report and the dealer report data to determine the species catch weights by area, the landed catch weights by area. And they do this by taking the vessel trip report estimates of catch by area, to take those ratios and apply them then to the true weights received from the dealer report. Adding to that will be assumed discard rate mortality that's based on the species and area of catch and the total weight of catch. That's added to the landed weight to determine the total mortality on a stock basis. All this information would then be provided to the managers, the NIMS managers, as well as the sector managers for sector management purposes. So the sector manager, of course, would use it to ensure that there's where they are within their allocations and use of their allocations, and possibly the need to move fish around between vessels or even possibly between sectors. So looking at the pros and cons of this option, it's a relatively low cost, minimal change to what you currently have, and does provide for somewhat more timely data management and utilization of the data. On the negative side, however, you still don't have any independent estimates of the at-sea discards or release of fish or the catch of species on an area and species-specific basis. You also don't have any independent verification of the land of weights. You're completely entrusting the dealers for providing accurate dealer reports. You haven't changed the incentives to the fishermen to fish more selectively, to reduce or minimize the mortality of releases at sea, or to avoid any releases or discarding. And the sectors will not be in a position, at least we don't believe they'll be in a position, to apply for an exemption from the assumed discard rate that the council utilizes. Option two, as we said earlier, builds upon option one by adding dockside monitoring. You have two options here, less than 100% dockside monitoring and or 100%. So NIMS continues to collect the VMS data for enforcement purposes. You still have your at-sea observer program that NIMS operates with its the percentage coverages that it has. The vessel again hails out, just like it did in the first program, advises where it's going and its intended landing date. But when it hails in, it now advises not only of its landing time and location, but of the estimated catch on board and the major species. And this is done for coordination purposes for observer services or monitoring services. So the vessel then, when it's hailing in, asks for a roving monitor and a dockside monitor. And in the case of a roving monitor, that's only when the vessel is landing at an outport where the fish will be trucked to a main location, an auction or a plant for sorting and weighing. Otherwise, it would just ask for a dockside monitor. Now, again, I said that you have two options, A and B. One is less than 100%, and the other is 100%. In the less than 100% option, the contractor then advises the vessel whether or not that trip will be monitored. And if it's if it is monitored, then a dockside monitor will be at the location where it will be sorted and weighed, and will monitor the sorting and record all the weights on a species basis. The monitor will also produce a landings report from that monitored events. The dockside monitor or the roving monitor will collect the vessel trip report from the vessel upon landing. If it's not a roving monitor there or a dockside monitor at the offload, then the fisherman is responsible for submitting the VTR within 7 days. The dealer continues to submit the dealer report within 7 days, and usually that would be electronically. The contractor then uses the landings report and the vessel trip report or the data of the dealer report to determine the species catch waste by area in much the same way they did under the option one. In this case, where you do have monitored offloads, the landings report would be used instead of the dealer report to know the true weight. You would use the ratio of catches by area that were estimated from the vessel trip report, apply those to the landings report to get the true weights on an area-specific basis. Again, you would assign assumed discard rate mortality based on the area and species of catch to determine the total mortality on a stock basis. And all of this information would be provided to both the sector manager and the NIMS fisheries managers for their purposes. Now, with option two, you have a few more benefits. You have the independent verification of the landings data. Again, it's more timely in terms of data management reporting. You'd hopefully have improved compliance, at least on the use of dockside weights, and you'd have improved TAC management. You still don't have independent estimates of at-sea releases or catch on an area species-specific basis. This option is clearly more expensive than the status quo or option one, and it also represents a significant change from the current scenarios. You still haven't changed the incentives for selective fishing or minimization or avoidance of discards and discard mortality, and you're still in a position where you can't apply for exemptions from the established discard mortality rates. The final option is option three. It builds on options one and two by adding at-sea monitoring to the dockside monitoring and the hail program. Again, you have various levels of at-sea monitoring, less than 100% of both electronic monitoring and at-sea observer coverage. Option B would be 100% electronic monitoring and less than 100% observer coverage. And then C would be both 100% electronic monitoring and observer coverage. Now, the way these options are presented, electronic monitoring would be vessels that are either gillnet or hook and line or trawl vessels fishing in a single area that are subject to mandatory retention would be eligible for electronic monitoring. Trawl vessels fishing multiple areas or not subject to mandatory retention would be required to take at-sea observers. So with option 3A, which is less than 100% EM, electronic monitoring and observer coverage, when the vessel hails out, it requests at-sea monitoring, either electronic monitoring or an observer. The contractor then advises the vessel whether or not it's required to take the electronic monitoring or the observer. And that's based on a statistical model that's trying to capture information about the vessel, the species of catch, and the area of catch, and the discard rates for all of those, as well as trying to compare monitored and unmonitored trips. If the vessel is required to take electronic monitoring or an observer, it can't leave the port until the electronic monitoring equipment is installed or the vessel has had an observer come on board. Option 3B would require that all vessels fishing gillnet, a long line or a set line, or a trawl vessels fishing in a single area subject to mandatory retention would then be required to have 100% electronic monitoring on board for every trip. Multi-area trawl vessels not subject to mandatory retention would have to take observers, but less than 100% of the time. And again, they would be advised by the contractor whether or not they were required to take an observer for that trip. And option three is just adds the 100% at-sea observer coverage for all trawl vessels doing multi-area, non-mandatory retention trips. So, regardless of the option, under any one of those options in three, when the vessel hails in, it's going to provide information about where it's landing, just like it did in the regular dockside monitoring program, the amount of fish being landed. At that point in time, the observer will disembark if it's an observer trip and will provide an observer report to the contractor. The vessel would likely be met by a roving monitor, or else it'll be landing at a port where it'll be dockside monitored, and the dockside monitor or the roving monitor would collect the hard drive from an electronic monitoring report and replace it with a new hard drive. The information then would be submitted again to the contractor, as would be the dockside monitoring data from the landings report, or as well as the VTR and the dealer reports would also be submitted. The contractor then reviews all of those reports, including the landings report, the vessel trip report, the electronic monitoring report, and the observer report. The data is reviewed. It's entered into the centralized database. As we have in the past, but now with at-sea monitoring data, you would calculate the species catch mortality on an area basis. In the case where it's 100% monitored, you'd be able to actually apply true mortality rates for released fish. And so an assumed mortality rate wouldn't be required. For vessels not requiring at-sea monitoring in those trips, assumed mortality rates would be applied to get total mortality on a stock-specific basis. And again, all of the information would be provided to the NIMS fisheries managers as well as to the sector managers. Sector managers, again, using them to ensure that they're staying within their allocations and to allow them to make changes of allocations amongst vessels within their fleet or possibly between fleets on an annual basis. So the benefits of option three with at-sea monitoring are clear. You now have an independent verification of landings, as well as independent verification of the retained and released catches on a species and area-specific basis. The data is more timely. It's improved compliance in terms of complying with all the rules for the fishery. You have improved TAC management due to the independent verification. And you provided incentives for the vessels to fish selectively, reduce their discards, and where possible reduce discard mortality and accurately report their catches while fishing. They can seek also exemptions from the set or established discard mortality rates and hopefully increase their sector allocations. Clearly it's a more expensive program and it represents significant change from the status quo. Just a little bit of clarification. The way the electronic monitoring program works is that when the vessel comes in and it provides its hard drive with its the data on it, a sample is taken, probably somewhere between 10 and 20% of the sets from the electronic monitoring. They're matched up with the vessel trip reports to ensure that they're accurate. If they coincide within acceptable discrepancy limits, the entire vessel trip report is deemed accurate and is accepted. If there's error levels that are too high, then additional levels of the electronic monitoring data are reviewed, up to potentially 100% of the data being used and replacing the vessel trip report altogether. So the Howard and I, after spending some time reviewing all the literature and meeting with individuals and organizations and talking to people, realized that there's clearly some need for improvements to monitoring for sector management. We've developed seven recommendations that we think would be worthy of consideration when moving towards sector management monitoring programs. Our first recommendation is that the common pool fishery should be required to have, at a minimum, option one monitoring in place. Essentially, you can view the common pool fishery as just another sector albeit perhaps a large one, and the needs for timely data management and information collection is apparent even in that fishery if you're trying to manage to some form of TAC or allowable catch limit. For sectors, though, we suggest that sector monitoring should be phased in over a 3-year period, with some form of dockside monitoring being required at the start of the program, and some form of at-sea monitoring required by the 3rd year. We also suggest that over the first 5 years that the programs be contracted to a single service provider, and that this doesn't necessarily have to stay that way over time, but our experience suggests to us that at the start of these programs, there's no centralized data management system set up for sector management. And indeed, the programs are developed, the computer programs and centralized systems are developed as the monitoring programs themselves are developed. And the effectiveness of a centralized system won't be really known, or the exact needs for a centralized system won't be known until some of the systems, the monitoring programs, have been in place for a few years. So if that's the case, during the first years of the program, it's probably more efficient and effective to have a centralized system for all the data to be entered into, to have a coordinated and unified reporting requirements, and to have an integrated system. There will be a number of data issues during the first years of the program that need to be worked out. It's far simpler to do that, to drill down into the data and find the errors and make the corrections if it's being done by a single service provider. Even if there is a single service provider, though, we do recommend that initially that it be done through a competitive bidding process, probably by a government agency, given the lack of coordinated industry organization and the probable multi-funding sources that might be in place. A government agency would probably be better suited to act on behalf of the industry as a contractor for the services. Industry should still be involved with the selection of the contractor, as well as finding ways of improving the overall efficiency of the program. Using a competitive RFP process will also establish what the needs of the program are through the statement of work, and will also hold the contractors to delivery of what they commit to in their proposals, as well as allow industry and the government to assess the contractors against their proposals. We suggest that while there's plenty of justification for some of the costs to be borne by a government, clearly the commercial fishery only represents a part of the overall use of the resource, and it is a public resource being managed for multiple users. And the benefits from a good manager of the resource will hopefully accrue to the public generally, as well as to the individuals involved. We would also suggest, though, that some cost recovery involving industry would also be useful. It ensures that industry uses the programs efficiently and effectively and works towards designs of the program that minimize costs but also meet the operational requirements of the sector. We would suggest an annual program evaluation, not only of the annual data from the fishery, but kind of comparative analysis across years to see that the programs are working effectively and the fishery is becoming more selective and properly accounting for the total removals on a stock basis. And finally, that there should be a comprehensive communications program that would prepare participants for the new monitoring initiatives and educate them on ongoing program developments and requirements, allow for feedback, and identify necessary contacts to industry. The communications program would also help not only provide two-way input to the program, but we would think it would also provide justifications and explanations for why program changes are being made. That concludes the presentation, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have.
Thanks, Bruce. Council members, questions? Dr. Pierce.
Thank you for that presentation. That was very informative. Just a couple of questions. I noticed in options 1 and 2, there is use of an assumed discard rate for both options. I believe that means that you're assuming a specific amount of discards and a mortality for those discards. Option 3 is a bit silent on that matter. Did you have any feelings regarding what we need to do with option 3? Does that also assume a specific amount of discards, or does it go beyond that?
The way the report lays it out is that with the for vessels that are monitored, the discard rates would be actual discard rates from the monitor trip. So the electronic monitoring would record discarded fish, and an established discard mortality associated with the species would be applied to those catches. So you would have the actual discards and estimated discard mortality for a trip. The same with the ATSI observer program. The observer would estimate releases, would apply a mortality rate either based on conditions of fish or condition factors for fish, or on tow time, depth of fish removals and species of fish, and then apply those to the estimates of releases on a species basis to determine the true mortality for that set and that trip. In the case where there was no monitoring on a trip under option 3, then assumed mortality rates would also be used as similar to what we're using options 1 and 2.
Okay, thank you. There clearly is a very heavy reliance on electronic monitoring for all of these options, and electronic monitoring is being indicated for trawl vessels too. Does that mean that after your interviews, after your travels throughout New England, you've concluded that indeed electronic monitoring programs can be effective for trawl vessels, that we would actually be in a position to determine amounts that are being discarded?
No, not at all. Electronic monitoring would likely not be viable for trawl vessels at all. With the exception, which is presented in the report, for trawl vessels that were fishing in a single area and that had mandatory retention requirements. So the electronic monitoring would be on board, but all it does then is confirm that no discarding is going on, so that the landed catch would accurately represent the total catch from the trip. The problem with electronic monitoring on trawl vessels that fish across areas or fish and release fish is that the electronic monitoring doesn't have the ability to estimate the catch and releases on an area basis, or estimate releases or quantities of releases, and again, species composition of releases. So it would only be applicable on mandatory retention for a single area.
Did you offer up any recommendations, any assessment of the degree to which electronic monitoring programs are reliable, that they cannot be gotten around in some way? In other words, if we go with electronic monitoring programs, through your experience and through what you've learned during the course of your travels, it would have a high degree of reliability and, cannot be gotten around?
Well, we have extensive electronic monitoring programs on the west coast of Canada. They've been in place for, been in place for about 7 or 8 years, but at 100% level for the last 2 years. And in all hook and line and set line fisheries, and have been are very reliable and very difficult to get around. When I say difficult, and you have to have rules in place. For example, if power on the vessel goes down, there are rules that have to be in place there because the camera stops working. There are situations that you have to make yourself aware of and prepare for, have rules around. But essentially, the programs have proved to be quite useful and reliable in some fisheries. The gillnet fishery is one that I know is being tested in the region here. I think Howard and I are confident that their systems can be set up that will work within the gillnet fishery, that you can properly monitor the catch on a species and a fish basis, similar to what we do in trap fisheries on the West Coast. We have electronic monitoring in trap programs, which land larger quantities at one time. But clearly, when you move to trawl fisheries, you have the scale of the catches and the fish on deck make electronic monitoring quite difficult.
Terry Stockwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That very interesting presentation. Thank you. One of the concerns I have is the cost and what it's going to cost the industry at a time when things are really quite dire. You mentioned as cons in both options 2 and 3 that they're more expensive, and you suggested a cost recovery program would likely be a part of the mix. Have you projected what the cost will be to industry to implement either of these options 2 or 3?
Well, that is part of the phase 2 report, so I can't give you any definitive numbers for this program. Howard will hopefully be here in June to give you that detail. But I will give you I'll give you some flavor for other programs. In British Columbia, we have 100% at-sea observer program in the trawl fishery. And that means that every trip, there's an observer that goes on the vessel for the entire trip and records most, if not all, of the tows and the catch that comes aboard. And the program is cost-shared between government and industry, with the government covering about a third of the cost, industry two-thirds of the cost. And the cost to the fishermen of that program, with 100% dockside monitoring and the hail program, so essentially what you would have here as option 3C, is in the neighborhood of 5 cents a pound for their fish, based on their land of value, their fish. Now, for electronic monitoring, again, for programs that we have in British Columbia, anywhere from that 3 to 7 cents a pound range for 100% electronic monitoring, 100% dockside monitoring, with a complete hail program as well. The scales of those programs, just to give you some ideas, we're looking in the trawl. For the trawl fishery, it's about 50 to 60 vessels. Lands about probably about 50,000 tons of fish annually, and worth about $50 million. The hook and line fisheries would be about 400 vessels. 350 to 400 vessels with a land of value of around $70 million. And most of those being longline vessels.
And the Canadian government pays what percentage?
A third. That's the ongoing cost. So where's some initial startup costs that the government absorbed? Mostly programming costs. They spent several hundred thousands of dollars on programming for a centralized database management system, which were picked up by the government.
Nancy?
I wasn't sure you saw my hand. I just wanted to ask a question about process more than anything else at this point. We were able to get a copy of the report, and thank you very much, a couple of weeks ago, we the center. And we obviously scrubbed through it really thoroughly because it's obviously a very important issue in terms of matching what you can do in terms of monitoring with what you can do in terms of management. And so I just want to know that, and in my view, what we did is we put together some really substantive comments. So I'm not really sure who I'm supposed to submit those comments to, but clearly, in my view, I think those comments that we put together could have an impact in phase two. So I've got comments that I'd like to direct to somebody, but I'm not exactly sure whom.
Well, you can either direct them to GMRI and they'll pass them on to Howard or I, or you can provide them to us directly. Either way.
Okay, thanks.
Nancy, you can also send those to the council. We'd like to see your perspective. Sally McGee.
Thank you. The timeline for implementation, can you provide any more details other than ramping up toward option three over the course of 3 years? Specifically, do you have an idea about how long it would take to get option one, which you describe as, and which is a modified status quo, implemented?
I don't believe option one would take very long at all. I mean, the phase two will help provide more detail and flush that out. A contractor should be able to set that system up in a relatively short period of time. If you want to quantify that, it would suggest in less than a year, probably something more like 6 months. The difficulty with the more detailed monitoring systems for dockside at sea monitoring, electronic or at sea observer, is establishing the infrastructure and then hiring and training and putting in place the staff to carry out the programs, as well as setting up the database systems for managing all the data in an integrated way. So that's more involved, will take more time, and obviously more expensive as well. So our experience, and I've probably implemented a half a dozen of these programs over the last 15 or 20 years, and you need the better part of a year to set up the infrastructure and have the program ready to operate.
Would it be different if, right now we have, I think, less than 50 permit holders who are currently a part of a sector. Would the timeline be different if a smaller number of permit holders were a part of a sector program to start and an additional smaller number would be added in subsequent years as you're kind of ramping up through the options that you spelled out and simultaneously ramping up the number of participants in this new management system?
Definitely, yes. I mean, the smaller the program is when it starts, the less difficult and the less involved with setting it up, and expansion can occur as the use of the programs expands as well, which would happen anyways. I haven't made a comment that the government needs to adapt, to these new programs as well, and their ability to receive and utilize the information. There are some sensitivities about data confidentiality that you have to work through to make sure that there's not going to be any breaches of those requirements. It just takes time to work through the processes.
Just a couple more points. You touched briefly on monitoring for common pool vessels. I don't know if you had any more thoughts on that. You just mentioned that, and as we've had discussion about common pool vessels being a kind of de facto sector, I'm not sure exactly what to ask, but did you look at what the monitoring needs are for the common pool vessels under the existing management system, and how a monitoring system that would be designed for sectors might be better, worse, indifferent for common pool vessels?
Well, our assumptions after our meetings and our discussions with the industry participants were that the common pool would continue to be managed with the input controls. Given that the focus of the report was about sector management and monitoring programs for sector management, we didn't really spend a lot of time trying to determine what the needs were for proper monitoring of common pool fisheries under continued input controls, other than to suggest, as we did in the report, that some type of minimum requirement would at least give you more timely information, assuming that, and this is may not be an accurate assumption, but assuming that even under the common pool, you're going to need to manage to some type of TAC, or annual catch limit. And if that's the case, then more timely information would be a requirement, and that's why we provided that option. So beyond that, we didn't really investigate it.
One more question, Mr. Chairman, and this has to do with cost sharing. And this might come in phase two in June, but I can't help but ask about any more detailed advice on the cost, how to split the cost, how to share the cost. You said that in the Canadian fishery that you mentioned, that the split is a third is paid for by government. But I guess, you know, part of the thought process is, how do you change the split over the course of time when the economics in the fishery improve? So I don't know if you can comment on that or how that might be brought back to the council in June in phase two.
Well, the experience that we have is that it's a negotiation between industry and government. In the programs that I've been involved with, that negotiation came out to the one-third, two-thirds, in part based on what the budgets were for the government, and also in part on what the expected benefits were to the industry from the programs, and the increased flexibility management organizational benefits that they would receive from it. Obviously, those are static numbers, and as you suggest, things change in time, and the economics of the industry may not always be as good in some times as they are in others. And industry has, at times, gone to the government and asked for a different split based on viability constraints. And it's, again, a negotiated process. And often becomes quite political, as I assume it would in this region as well. There is no, there is no magic formula, and the Phase 2 report won't present one. It'll try to capture the costs and discuss the process for reaching some type of shared funding arrangement, but it'll ultimately be a negotiation.
Pat?
Two points, I guess. The first, I'm a little confused by the answer having to do with how long it might take with fewer boats versus more boats, and I certainly understand that fewer boats is less of a complication, but the time-consuming part of it is building the infrastructure, and you have to build the infrastructure regardless of whether it's one boat or 1,000 boats. So I'm not entirely sure that it would take less time with fewer boats. And then the second point is we have very different statutory and legislative frameworks that we're working under in the U.S. than in Canada, and I would suggest that some of the U.S. Constraints preclude some of the options that are viable in Canada, and I hope that's going to be considered in your report?
On the infrastructure question or comment, clearly the establishing the infrastructure isn't just whether you're going to have one vessel or 500 vessels involved. It's the size of the infrastructure to handle the amount of the number of dockside monitors, the number of at-sea observers, and the size, the number of vessels that are calling on the program. So if you only have 50 vessels utilizing the program, the number of monitors and observers and electronic monitoring equipment and staff that you need to handle the hails, et cetera, is far smaller and than it is if you have 500 or 1,000. So the scale is different. It does take more time for a larger program. The legislative requirements, yes, I mean, I'm certainly aware of the different systems that we operate under in terms of the rules and the legislation that you utilize. I'm not sure that anything, if you can be more specific, I'd appreciate it, but right now I'm not sure what we've presented here is not doable based on your legislation, but certainly we look for advice on that because we'd like to clarify that in phase two of the report.
We'll provide some specific comments.
Thank you.
The cost share option is not an option for us.
Dave Gith.
Yeah. I don't really know where to start. I mean, there's a lot of information here, but to me, you've provided kind of three options, and I like to relate things to things that are a little more easy to deal with than all this alphabet soup. So let's try cars in this case. You've provided us with a Yugo option, a Ford option, and a tricked-out Hummer option. And here in New England, we love to buy tricked-out Hummers, but we only got a Yugo budget. So anything you do in phase two, we're going to need something that will fit the New England groundfish fishery, which has a range of boats from very small to what we would call large boats, but on the Pacific West Coast, they would be called small boats. You know, a 100-foot boat here in New England is a large boat. So we have people grossing from, say, $10,000 a year to maybe $1 million. So we need kind of a one-size-fits-all setup that isn't going to put the guy who grosses $10,000 out of business because it costs him $20,000 to buy the system. So I think this ability to pay is a very serious consideration. Unless our rich uncle steps up to the plate, who always claims he's poor, or some charitable trust decides to step in and pay for this, not just the first year, but on a continuing basis, for the life of the program, however long that is. We're going to have to, budget is very much going to enter into it. With that in mind, I'd like to know which one of these systems do you find, how well do they work in practicality? Do all three of these work as well, or, what's the practical aspects of this versus the theoretical?
First of all, I agree with you. The options here go from the Yugo to the Cadillac, you said. And the decision on which model or make that you use won't be ours. It'll be up to the council and the NIMS and the industry what they want to accept. All of those models work. It depends on what your objectives are and what you want and what you need. What are your minimum requirements from the program in terms of data management and data for meeting your obligations under the new legislation? But they all can work. It's a risk management decision about the level of monitoring that you have. What's the risk with having low levels of monitoring in terms of proper TAC or stock management? So those are obviously difficult issues. but they all will provide you better information than what you have right now, and then you'll have to decide what's adequate. We present it in a way where you can look at the different options, value them in a relative sense, and determine where you want to start. You don't necessarily have to start with the Cadillac. You may want to start with something far less than that, and determine if you want to advance from there in time. It would also address things like implementation issues. Don't think that a 15-foot boat can't use these systems. I'm involved with many programs that have 15-foot jig boats that are fishing with a hand line, 200 pounds a day of rockfish, and using 100% electronic monitoring. So, and that costs them about $50 a day for monitoring.
I think that's my question, is the electronic aspect of this. Call me old-fashioned. I'm not even real comfortable with the VMS. I don't think it works all that well. I still navigate with a compass and a watch, even though I got a wheelhouse full of multi-$1,000 electronics, because most of them fail every time I really need them. That's what I'm concerned with, is this electronic aspect. I mean, it's things about swapping out hard drives and cameras and, all these kind of electronic gadget-type things. And, I'd like to know more about, the failure rates of these things and what happens when they fail. I mean, anytime somebody mentions swapping out a hard drive, the last time somebody flew over my wife's computer and the word hard drive was mentioned, the next thing I knew it was in the trash and we were off to Best Buy for a new one.
Very low.
I'm concerned about this.
Yeah, and that's a valid concern. The programs that I've familiar with, we're at very, very low failure rates, less than 1%.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to belabor the EMP issue, but I share much of Dave's questioning about EMP. It seems like I paid attention to what you said down in New Bedford about this, and particularly how the EMP interface with enforcement. And I agree with Dave as far as the physical bugs are concerned, but what operational bugs did you run into? There's got to be something that I'm not seeing here, because it just seems to me like EMP is an awful lot of bang for the buck. And when you get the fully developed system, what I see here is 100% EMP / at sea observers. What mix do you see as being appropriate for us between the very expensive at sea observer program and what appears to be a much less expensive electronic monitoring program? How do you arrive at a decision on what percentages it should be and what kind of operational bugs and enforcement bugs are we likely to run into early on until we get used to it? Because it's going to be a whole new approach for New England.
There will be lots of bugs. And the actual proportion of observers versus electronic monitoring is essentially up to the fleet. I mean, in terms of whether they choose to use one or the other, the actual percentage of coverage requirements is somewhat up to National Marine Fisheries Service and what their objectives are for the program. But, I mean, if a vessel, a trawl vessel, wants to continue to fish in multi-areas and not be subject to mandatory retention, then we see no other way other than to have an observer. If he wants to reduce his costs and move to a single-area mandatory retention, then he can go to electronic monitoring. Now, there are bugs with electronic monitoring when you first get started. And as I described earlier, the electronic monitoring report is essentially an audit system for the vessel trip report. So the vessel trip report, if it's not accurate, is going to run into problems when matched up with the electronic monitoring data. And you have to, obviously, the fishermen have to become acutely aware of the need to properly fill out their vessel trip report. That takes time. And in fact, in programs I've been involved with, it takes a good year or two so that they understand the need to properly and accurately record their data in their vessel trip report. We call it a logbook on the West Coast. And so that, because if it doesn't match up well, then you have to look in more and more of the electronic monitoring report data, the electronic monitoring data. And that's costly because you're paying a contractor so much an hour to review the electronic monitoring data. If he only has to do 10%, it's not very expensive. If he has to do 100%, it can cost just as much as an observer, having an observer on for the entire trip. So those bugs are clearly there. There will be data management bugs. Just a collection of dockside data or dealer report data, matching it up with vessel trip reports and at sea monitoring data. Sometimes a report, the species is different species. And then you have to find out, mesh these things together, and you have to kind of drill into the data and work them out and find solutions to avoid it, future type problems. So those are just data management issues that will be there, operational issues that you'll see at the start of a program. Enforcement-wise, it'll take a while for enforcement to see how best to utilize the programs, how to utilize the data from the programs to complement their work, or how their work would best be suited to ensure the compliance with the monitoring programs. And that will take some time. And at first, they may want to just look at the data and so they can do random checks to make sure they're compliant. They might want to use the data to ensure vessels are fishing in almost as a replacement for their VMS information to monitor compliance with fishing in open areas versus closed areas and so on. But, that will take some time. Our experience is that monitoring programs have greatly enhanced enforcement programs because it gives them more tools, more eyes and ears, more information to use. Figuring out how best to use that is what takes some time and is a challenge. Also, moving away from, and this is not just a monitoring issue, but moving away from input controls to the output controls, which are married with better monitoring systems. Our experience, again, is that it has greatly reduced the number of violations and required prosecutions. When I was a manager of groundfish fisheries for the Pacific region for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans back in the 80s, I used to have at least one court case a week that I had to go to. In the late 90s, after we changed to complete monitoring systems, and I might have a half a dozen a year. It's just because the programs with monitoring improve compliance. And also, by moving to different systems away from the input controls, you remove the number of potential violation opportunities. But the message is that the experience is that once enforcement utilizes the monitoring systems to their benefit, the fisheries run better.
Just a quick one. At what point with the VTRs would you consider, what percentage discrepancy would you consider to be acceptable? And at what point do you say, okay, here's a violation, or this may be a violation, and we want to look further into the electronic data that we have? At what point do you make those decisions?
Yeah, those are all different standards. Some of those will be clarified in the phase two of the report. And they might be a little bit looser at the start of the program. In fact, we would suggest that they would be looser at the start of the program and then tightened up as the program matures and moves on. Some of our based on numbers. It depends on how much data is collected from the program, from the electronic monitoring program that you're comparing to the vessel trip reports. If it's one set, then you're going to compare the complete set with the VTR. If there's 10 sets or 10 strings of gear, you might compare 10%, and then within that you might allow a 10% discrepancy. And if it's only so many fish, you might actually base it on, you know, a number, an actual number of fish. So there are some different guidelines that you would want to establish, but some of that information will be forthcoming. But it depends, you know, it would vary. And again, what we've done now on the west coast of Canada is that the rules are much more stringent now. The allowed error rates are narrower because we've given them time to adjust to the program, and our expectations can be higher.
Okay, Bruce, thank you very much. We look forward to your colleague's second report and our follow-up report in June, the June Council meeting. We're going to take a 5 to 10 minute break, and when we come back, we're going to have a presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.